Greetings, this is William Evans. We're shifting gears. And our guest today is Mark Barish, founder and executive director of the Green World Campaign and author of the recent book, The Compassionate Life. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So we've been together at a wonderful meeting up the valley for the past 2 days called Conscious Global Leadership. And it was really built around the tree. We had a tree in the center of the room, and as we walked in, and tell me a little bit about the dream you had.
Well, yes, I did have a dream about a tree that was very meaningful to me and very impactful. You know, I've also written books on dreams, so I'm very attentive to the power of dreams. And this was, to make it simple, a dream in which I saw what I understood to be the world tree, which was very beautiful and had a profusion of leaves and branches and was almost like a baobab. It was a really extraordinary tree. And I was sort of rejoicing being in its shadow. And then suddenly all the leaves started to fall off and I could see bare branches. And I wondered why this was happening. It wasn't really autumn in the dream. And I saw, to my horror and shock, that the tree was hollow, that had a hollow trunk, and that the roots had shriveled, and that this tree was dying. I took it to be, in the dream even, something about the state of the world, the state of the environment, the state of, in a sense, the civilization that we've created it, and the inflection point that we've arrived at, which is almost kill or cure, really. I think that's a pretty wide consensus now, scientifically. And at the end of the dream, I was carrying away a sapling, and I had no idea what this meant. But it was a dream that I sort of carried with me. And 10 years later, I found myself quite by chance involved with agroforestry and tree planting. And the way you do that is you plant seeds in seedbed nurseries and grow them until they're saplings. So it had symbolic meaning of the need for really a new tree, in a sense, a new global order, a new way of living together in this world with each other and in harmony with the natural order, the natural world. And also something that was very personal, that actually adumbrated an entire life path that I had no expectation of ever embarking upon, which is running the Green World Campaign that I founded, which is planting trees now in 6 countries, primarily agroforestry. These are developing world countries, smallholder farmers, small villages at the edges of forests. And it's been essentially a volunteer operation that has aggregated to itself, or people have self-aggregated to it, you know, an extraordinary kind of collaboratory that is global and involves on-the-ground work as well as media dissemination of these ideas, and people that I think also have a globalist perspective. This isn't like USAID or conventional, even United Nations Environmental Program. It's really something that has a sort of a spiritual understanding, very non-denominational and nothing heavy-handed, but just a spiritual in the sense of holism and wholeness and healing as being the central metaphors. What really appealed to me about being able to restore degraded land was the idea that we have the power to collaborate with nature and co-create, not just protect what's left, which is a vital and an essential task for all of us, but also to restore not only land, but communities, and to recreate biodiversity. It's quite extraordinary, the alchemy of the soil and what you actually can do with the, in a sense, the humblest materials on Earth, which are so-called bottom of the pyramid, but very resourceful smallholder farmers working for $2 a day usually, and barren land that people have given up on, and villages that are blowing away. But when you add knowledge and seeds and some funds and I would say some quotient of love and partnership, because of course these people know exactly what they're doing, and if they're given the resources, they're able to do this for themselves. You really have an an alchemical metaphor of something starting with the stone the builders cast aside, as they say in alchemy, and what can grow out of that, and sort of the transmutation of the world. So that's part of the meta agenda, if you will, of the Green World Campaign, is not only to really accomplish something together as a kind of a global class project, to take a green crayon and color some of these areas of the globe in that are turning brown, but also to create a genuine sense of the global village and to apply holistic and integral principles to a real-world task, and to also create feedback loops. It's another aspect of our work is to be able to geotag and map what we're doing so we can actually see the results of our work, and we can know that this isn't a black box, that we haven't just sort of kicked in a couple of dollars and hope for the best, but something is actually happening that is changing the world, and in a very literal sense.
You started to talk yesterday, and when you told us about the dream, you did it quite succinctly there, and it was in the context of we were planting trees at the meadows, and you said you had a dream that the tree of life was dying. You used another phrase I loved, and that was about one of our major problems, and we have a beautiful living solution to that. Would you use that phrase and say more there?
Oh, yeah. I was saying that there was a we do have in our possession a solar-powered device so simple that a child can operate it, that also acts as a carbon dioxide splitter, an oxygen provider. And I think without putting too fine a point on it, you know what I'm talking about.
I think everybody knows what you're talking about, and it's a beautiful phrase. Yeah.
And this is something it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of talk about emergency measures for global climate change. I mean, this actually emanated from the White House a few months ago. John Holdren, who is, I think, co-chair of the White House Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and is a former Woods Hole scientist, and knows a great deal about forestry, and in fact has said that massive afforestation of degraded land in the tropical belt could account for as much as 30% of the solution to the global climate change puzzle. But he hasn't really made that utterance publicly. And what he did talk about was he said if there is a kind of runaway climate change effect, that we will have to try to do global geoengineering, as he called it. And this is something that's emanating from bodies like the Heritage Foundation, and I think that Halliburton and NASA and a lot of other large engineering entities would like in on this potential gravy train, where they're proposing launching mirrors into space to block sunlight, to recreate smog through sulfur dioxide with the rockets and jet bombers. It's amazing stuff.
Well, and it's amazing how complex we make things that are basically so simple and beautiful.
Yeah.
And provide habitat for creatures and activate the rain cycle. Because
yeah.
We know where there are forests, there's rain.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that really appealed to me about afforestation, agroforestry, reforestation, that it's sort of the Swiss Army knife of nature. You know, a tree does so much. And when you really look at it in a whole systems model, and you see that, yes, it's the rain cycle. Trees actually can bring back aquifers. They actually can draw water back up, and the water goes into the atmosphere, creating microclimates. It refertilizes soil. But more than that, the oldest form of agriculture is this word I keep using, agroforestry. When the conquistadors discovered the New World, and subsequent to that, for hundreds of years, we didn't recognize that what we were looking at in the Amazon, certain large swaths of the Amazon, was an agroforestry project by the indigenous people. There have been estimates now, and this is very new data, the last maybe 3 or 4 years, that as much as 30% of the Amazon is the result of the hand of humankind.
An intentional garden has terra preta or biochar in the soil that also takes carbon out of the atmosphere.
Yes, exactly. And they're trying to recreate that. There are a lot of interesting biochar projects. But it just says that really there are synergies in the soil, that when you treat the soil well and you plant certain types of vegetation, certain types of crops, and certain types of trees, the entire system is mutually energizing, and you can actually restore land that has been written off. I mean, it's a very interesting case when I was first beginning this work that I saw in a New York Times article on southern Niger, which all the development agencies had just washed their hands of. It was desertifying. The population was increasing. There was drought. And all of a sudden, over a period of years, they noticed that it was getting greener on satellite images. And none of the agencies could figure this out. So they all trooped down there. And they discovered that the farmers had decided to stop cutting down the gao tree, an ancestral tree, and it started replanting it. And the idea that you're supposed to cut down trees to make farms is absurd, as it turns out. And when you plant the gao tree and you plant vegetables around it in the same field, you get a sort of a hyper-productivity of your food crops. And so this area, with a few simple tools and manure pits and dug with sticks, they were able to restore an area to greenness that had been desertifying, basically, that they would have all had to migrate. I've seen this as I've gotten more and more into this field all over the world, not very well publicized, instances where marginal land, or worse than marginal, has been brought back to thriving fertility. Even the recreation of biodiverse rainforest is possible through this alchemy that's ongoing.
Well, in health, there's a circle. And restoring trees can heal the circle in places where it's broken and where scrub and drought has left a desert. Renewal is possible.
Yes, and so sometimes you find if you begin to simply shade the soil with trees and it gets a little moisture, tree species that were thought extinct will pop up out of the soil. Wildlife will come back that people thought was long gone. You really actually get biodiversity. And also it provides fodder for animals, building materials, and a sustainably harvested firewood and cash crops and fruit. It's really almost limitless possibilities. And we did one project in Ethiopia that we call Bees and Trees, which is an example of this synergy, where coleandra trees were planted, which produce big blossoms that pollinators like to gather from. And therefore, by planting these trees, the wild plants were populated for biodiversity, coffee plants were pollinated, and the honey hives prospered, so that you created economic benefits as well as benefits for the environment.
Yeah, Paulo Lugari at Gaviotas took basically barren land and turned it into a forest and sustains a community from that.
Yes, I was talking to somebody about Gaviotas actually at our meeting that we were referencing a few minutes ago. And they mentioned, this is actually somebody from the Rocky Mountain Institute here in the Valley. And they pointed out, as I've been pointing out to people as well, that there are actually sustainable enterprises, micro-enterprises or beyond possible using barren land because nobody wants it. And nobody understands that it can be renewed. And I think the value of the land at Gaviotas went up, I don't know the exact figure, it was like 50 times or something, because somebody took the trouble to nurture it, to look at the extraordinary ability of natural systems to heal, whether it's the body or the environment itself.
And that's the huge lesson of our time, that turnaround from destroying to healing and sustaining the forest, and the forest sustains us.
Yeah, I think everything I do, because I have been a cancer patient and I've done extensive writing about healing, and to me the miracle of healing is the central metaphor of my life. And once you look at the world through that lens, you see the incredible possibilities and potential of your own life, other people's lives, because we are trying to heal lives and communities with these projects as well as the environment. I think people are often left out of the equation, and to really be able to work holistically in the world, we have to, of course, look at ourselves as human beings as part of this natural system. And as I alluded earlier, kind of co-creators of the garden, as we always have been, not just the pathogen, as some environmentalists are coming to conclude.
Well, many of the indigenous communities have known this wisdom for a long time. I think if we're going to make the great turnaround, we're going to learn how to heal ourselves and the earth at the same time.
Yes, and this turnaround is really possible. And when you look at the volume of land and the number of willing hands around the world, massive afforestation is possible. And Green World Campaign, by the way, if anyone's interested, it's www.greenworld.org. We're really trying to move into this space in as big a way as we're capable of, as much as we're funded for, to really both make the world aware of this and to practice it, the possibility of genuine transformation. I've been amazed, in dozens of countries to see grassroots efforts to do this afforestation work. And I recently was asked to work with the United Nations Forum on Forest Secretariat. I'm actually going to Rome in 2 weeks to confer with them. And next year, as it turns out, is the International Year of Forests. Very often, people don't know about these UN International Year of Fill in the Blank. I mean, it could be International Year of Lederhosen, and these things just tend to disappear. But I'm very intent on using whatever sort of media abilities I might have, and that really is my primary background prior to this, to really get the word out and to look at this as a global collaborative venture to really make a difference, to really be able to look at a satellite map 5 or 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and see that we have created a legacy of healing all across the planet, and that these brown areas really have turned green. And it's absolutely in our hands, absolutely possible, and very cost-effective. It doesn't really cost that much to plant a tree in these areas in the developing world where we're working.
So the Green World Campaign has been running for how many years?
It's been 5 years. It was just kind of a kitchen table idea and rather audacious and I really had no idea how it would develop. It was really, in a sense, the formation and the growth of the organization had very much to do with this philosophy of sort of trust and healing and assuming that there are hidden patterns in the world in a way that will emerge if you water them and give them sunlight and if you just plant certain seeds. So I've been quite amazed at what's emerged. My chief operating officer, who just showed up and volunteered to work for us for $1 a year, was a country director at the World Bank in his former life.
All right.
And was responsible for some $4 billion in environmental grants and is one of the world's experts in really country-level and regional projects. He was the man who helped bring Eastern Europe out of the environmental dark ages after the wall fell. So he was really kind of a giant in his field, and I'm sometimes amazed that Anand Seth, is his name, would actually go and sleep in some fleabag hotel in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on our behalf, just to do the monitoring and evaluation of a small program that we're nurturing. So we have a lot of people who really could be working for much more prestigious organizations that are sort of moved by the basic philosophy, I suppose, and the way that we're trying to do this in terms of, as I said, sort of emergent properties and self-aggregation and a lot of interesting organizational principles that are being talked about more and more in business schools, that there is sort of an innate intelligence to just as there is to a seed that has its own DNA that unfolds, to the seeds of organization and the seeds of human awareness and the groups as seeds. So one of our slogans is planting a seed of spirit in the soil of the world. Like, how do we take the highest principles that humanity has collectively evolved and really ground them in this dirt under the fingernails kind of work?
So the ancestral wisdom in a seed grows into a tree, which brings rain, and just models for us what we already intuitively know, but can sometimes forget in our confusion, that health is a circle of many equitable exchanges. And when we gift the forest gifts us fruit, vegetables, animals, birds, and rain.
Yeah, and I think, again, if we add people to the equation, it's the same thing. We're giving a gift of partnership. And by working with the global village in a real sense, then we are, of course, helping ourselves.
We're part of the circle.
A lot of the solution to the climate change problem are things that are very humble. Something as simple as we work in partnership with a group that puts composting toilets into villages, which also creates fertilizer. We are making alliances with groups that do low CO2 eco-efficient stoves. Stoves are a tremendous source of pollution. Open fires and primitive kind of cooking arrangements, lighting arrangements, and this all affects us. I mean, it's the proverbial butterfly's wing in Tokyo in chaos theory. I think that I've noticed lately that there is a problem in the environmental movement as it's playing out, at least in the U.S. these days, that although I'm a big fan of local living economies and locavore eating and all the rest of it, it's almost a feeling of eco-gated communities that we're going to perfect the places that we live, which we should do, and it's our responsibility to the rest of the world to do that. But we can't leave the rest of the world out of the equation. And people are sometimes a little puzzled when I'll say, well, what about we also help people in Ethiopia or the Philippines or Kenya or Uganda or India or Mexico, which are the countries we're working, and do it at the same time, because it's only one world. There's only one reality here. And people seem to sometimes assume that there's a trickle-down effect, that we'll just get our own house in order and that will trickle down to these people that we're working with on the ground. And it doesn't really work that way. I think we're past that. That's a naive and partial view of the realities of our existence here in the world as a global civilization, and that I'm always looking for ways to combine what we need to do here at home as the biggest emitter of CO2 and biggest consumer of resources with what has to happen in the among the poorest of the poor.
And the word "and" is a beautiful connective word, local and global.
Yes. I mean, that was always, the ideal of the global village. And I find it, interestingly, I've spent a lot of time in London lately and in Berlin and European capitals, where I think there's still a little more outward-facing understanding of the world. And I have found some very interesting partnerships there as well. And the ends are, yeah, I think this is an era of the end. We can proclaim it here. You heard it first. But because it's also things like charitable work and sustainable enterprise. I mean, that when I mentioned spending time in London, it triggered that thought that I've run into this as a model a great deal, what they call hybrid or fusion models, that you can't just keep pouring water in the bucket, especially if it has a hole and leaks out, and you're constantly having to refund everything. But how can we create models that are non-predatory, obviously, models, but involve the best strengths of enterprise and micro-enterprise in particular, and appropriate technologies, and the melding of ancient wisdom and modern knowledge and economic systems that can be, I think, also healed.
So one of the questions I would have is, have you gotten to the point yet with this experience where you've created a forest, a resource that people can begin to see, and are they able to own it and live in it and not have someone else externally come in and appropriate their resources?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we work with villages where we're invited, and we work particularly with regional groups that are indigenous groups that have been working in some cases in Ethiopia, for example. Our partner there used to be the African Biodiversity Network, which was a group of local lawyers that were protecting indigenous land rights from, for example, Chinese tea plantations that were starting to come in and encroach on the Menengasha forest.
Oh, that's huge. That's wonderful, because you know, that's traditionally what we have done, is we've gone in and taken the resources and displaced the people from their land and their forest.
Yeah, no, it's quite, this is healing in situ. I mean, that's what alchemy is all about. You start right where you are with the raw materials you find at hand.
Yes.
And you assume that inherent in that, in the collective intelligence, for example, of the people who are already there, the solutions already exist. I mean, there was a movement in India years ago called Sarvodaya, which, as I understood it, is a disciple of Gandhi's that founded this. And he just would go to villages as the outsider, as the catalyst, as the outside agent, and gather the stakeholders together from different sectors of the society and say, what's the problem? and how do we solve it together? And then sort of having created the framework, sort of absent himself from the conversation. And I would always find that the solutions already existed, that the wisdom was already inherent, just like the soil and the seeds already know how to collaborate to grow a tree. I mean, a seed is this tiny dot of information, essentially, that mobilizes resources that already exist in the environment. That principle, I think, applies as above, so below. It applies at all levels of endeavor and all levels of sort of functioning of the cosmos, if you will.
And those seeds have been accumulating wisdom for thousands, if not millions, of years.
Yeah, I think when I talk to people that are particularly advocates of geoengineering, I say, well, you know, a tree has been field tested for 670 million
That's
years.
That's great.
You know, I think it's proven itself to be safe for the environment. You know, so why do we need to do these other things? And plus, of course, all the other benefits that a tree provides. But you know, I want to say a little more about this collaboratory. The people working with in Ethiopia, for example, that they are also mapping the forests with the indigenous people. So you actually have multiple layers of knowledge that are being incorporated into these maps, that some of them are being one of the maps is to protect land claims, essentially, and land tenure. The other one might be, here's a sacred site. Here's where these animals are. Here's our ancestral dolmen. They actually bring children from the local schools, they're working in 40 schools, out into the forests with the elders, the traditional elders, to transmit the traditional lore to these children. They're working in 40 schools now. Then the children go back to their schools and they grow seedbed nurseries. And when the saplings are grown, they bring them out into the villages and plant them. And so it's creating, again, this sort of holistic model. And I'm actually hoping to link schools here in the U.S. with the schools and other places where we're working so that we really can begin to take advantage of the extraordinary communicative capacities that we've created technologically as well, that we could actually be in touch. We can actually Skype the people that we're working with. You know, it's quite amazing.
This has been wonderful, Mark. This is William Evans. I'm speaking with Mark Barish. This is Shifting Gears. You're listening to KDNK. Thank you for listening.